We come now to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of David Seymour.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister and reads as follows. Does she stand by all her government's policies and actions?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes, particularly the government's climate change work programme, including the release today of the final advice from the Climate Commission. The Commission's analysis shows the 30-year transition to a low emissions economy is achievable, will create jobs and new opportunities for Kiwi businesses, and will provide business with certainty to invest in new technology to enter new markets. The Climate Change Commission's advice has confirmed the government has made good progress to reduce emissions, passing the Zero Carbon Act and improving the emissions trading scheme, investing in public transport, rail, cycling and walking infrastructure and EV infrastructure around the country. Budget 2021 is doubling funding for the Low Emissions Contestable Fund over the next 4 years, developing a vehicle's emission standard for new imports and a mandate to include biofuels in petrol and diesel, and helping businesses to switch to clean energy with the Government Investment in Decarbonising Industry Fund. The Commission's report makes clear there is more to do, and we'll consider the Commission's advice over coming months as we develop our emissions reduction plan.
Very good.
Which of the Climate Change Commission's recommendations, if any, will the Prime Minister rule out implementing?
Mr. Speaker, by law, we are required as a government under the Zero Carbon Act to go through due process in considering the advice from the Climate Commission as we formulate an emissions reduction plan and as we formulate our emissions budgets. And so I'm going to undertake that in good faith.
Why does the Prime Minister expect the public to believe that the population will keep growing, the economy and living standards will keep growing, and carbon emissions will reduce by 63% in the next 14 years? That's more than half.
Order. The member's asked a question. It's a very long one already.
Tiny little addition.
If it's a question, yes. If it's not, no.
Okay, well, all I was going to add, Mr. Speaker, for the Prime Minister's benefit, is give her a little context that carbon emissions have been rising every year this century in contrast to...
Oh, well, that's in conflict with what I just said. So the member can start again and use another supplementary.
Expensive business. How does the Prime Minister expect the public to believe that emissions are going to painlessly decrease by 63% in the next 14 years when every year this century, on average, emissions have increased so far?
Mr. Speaker, I don't think anyone's suggesting that change won't be required. The point that the Climate Commission has made is that the foundations the government has laid are the right ones. We just need to make sure that we keep going and that we lift the pace. The alternative, if we don't do that, is that the potential cost to the economy will be greater due to inaction than it will be via action.
Supplementary. When the Prime Minister said that the government has laid the foundations and needs to increase the pace, was she referring to the record 1.1 million tonnes of coal imported last year, or the fact that emissions have actually increased under her government? Which is she going to accelerate?
Mr. Speaker, the member raises the issue with New Zealand's electricity generation. One of the issues that we're facing, of course, is that whilst we have a very high rate of renewables in New Zealand, in a hydrological dry year, we have a major problem. And so we have to look at options to try and overcome that. We've laid the foundation for that piece of work. We're laying the foundations for New Zealand to finally have clean car standards so that we don't continue, particularly in an era where other countries will start phasing out the use of internal combustion engines, where we start putting in some standards around what's imported into New Zealand so that we don't end up being the dumping ground of other countries. We are starting the work by incentivising industry who, through manufacturing processes, are using fossil fuels for production to support them to transition. And it's excellent to see some of those higher users, for instance, the likes of Fonterra, making very ambitious plans to change the way they undertake their processing, which will be good for all of us.
Supplementary.
Sorry?
Simon Court.
Will the Prime Minister commit to ensuring that any climate change policies are subject to a cost-benefit analysis?
Mr. Speaker, we are obliged to go through a rigorous process. And, of course, the Climate Commission, as part of their report, have encouraged us in particular areas to undertake that process, including, and let's acknowledge what they've said around our ambition of 100% renewable electricity. So that's one of the areas they've called for that. And we're undertaking a business case and analysis around the way that we would achieve that through projects like Onslow to see whether or not it offers the solution that New Zealand is looking for. So the member can engage in that process over the next several months, and I encourage him to do so.
The Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Prime Minister, is she aware, when she referenced Fonterra, that they're having to actually burn coal to dry the wood at Brightwater?
Mr. Speaker, I reference the fact that they are working to transition their energy generation in their processing plants. If the member is contesting that ambition, I'd suggest she raise that with Fonterra, because that is very much part of their public planning. And if the member thinks it's to our benefit to continue to use fossil fuels as part of our clean, green image as we export our dairy products, she is definitely out of step with where Fonterra is heading.
Mark Cameron.
Will she rule out implementing the Commission's recommendations, which could see total dairy cattle numbers and sheep and beef numbers fall by 13%?
Mr. Speaker, I'd refer to the first answer. I believe it was the first answer I gave to Mr. Seymour around fulfilling our obligations in not responding immediately, but going through due process and considering the Commission's report.
Question number two, Helen White.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
Mr. Speaker.
The wholesale and manufacturing sectors are contributing to supporting the recovery. This morning, Stats New Zealand reported a continued rise in manufacturing sales volumes in the March quarter, up 0.4% from the previous quarter to reach a record peak of $27 billion. The biggest contribution came from the electronic and electrical equipment manufacturing sector. Outputs from this industry fed into the exports of optical, medical and measuring equipment goods, which have increased over 50% during the last 12 months. Meat and dairy products manufacturing sales volumes rose 1.3% in the March 2021 quarter, the second largest industry rise. Separately, wholesale trade sales rose 3.7% in the March 2021 quarter, a rebound from a decline in the previous quarter. And the biggest contribution here came from motor vehicles and motor vehicle parts industry.
Supplementary, what other reports has he seen on the economy?
Mr. Speaker, the government's efforts to secure the recovery is reflected in the jobs market. The SEEK New Zealand employment report increased by 5.1% in May from the previous month to a record high for job advertising numbers. For the year, job ads rose 193%. More importantly, Mr. Speaker, job ad numbers have now surpassed pre-COVID marks by more than 20%. BNZ economists noted, quote, "It's not enough to say job advertising has fully recovered. It is now exceptionally strong."
Supplementary. What reports has he seen on the impact of climate change on the economy?
Well, Mr. Speaker, as we've heard today, the final report of the Climate Commission was released. It shows that we can build on the progress that the government has already made to meet our climate targets in a way that is affordable and achievable. The Commission has revised its modelling of the GDP impact. It now estimates the level of GDP could be around 0.5% lower in 2035 and 1.2% lower in 2050 than it otherwise would have been. This does not account for co-benefits such as health improvements or wellbeing benefits. Importantly, the Commission has now included an estimate of the impact on GDP of delaying action. It says that delay, particularly in deploying electric vehicles and improved farm practices, could result in the level of GDP in 2050 falling by around 2.3%. The government welcomes this report and is now working its way through its recommendations for our response.
Supplementary,
Andrew Bailey.
Has he seen the ANZ New Zealand Business Outlook report, which showed that 86% of businesses are expecting higher costs ahead, which is bad news for supernumeraries and low-income earners?
Well, Mr Speaker, yes, I have seen that report, and what it does say is that firms are very optimistic about their own outlook, which is going up, their export intentions, their investment intentions, and their profit expectations. So I tend to look on the optimistic side of the report, Mr Speaker.
Question number three, the Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does she stand by all of her government statements and actions?
Mr Speaker, yes. In particular, I stand by this government's focus on a COVID-19 immunisation program centred on the Pfizer vaccine and welcome yesterday's announcement of 1 million doses arriving in July. This means double the number of vaccines will be received by the end of next month, and we'll have enough stock to fully vaccinate 1 million New Zealanders. With this announcement, we can continue ramping up our rollout to the general population next month, and we'll ensure everyone in New Zealand who wants a vaccine will be offered one before the end of the year. With around 20,000 doses a day currently being administered and greater certainty of supply, the government is on track to reach the peak of our program in August and September, where we will deliver roughly 50,000 doses per day. Mr Speaker, offering a vaccine to every New Zealander who wants
one
is the best way as a country we can secure our recovery.
Supplementary. Why has she prioritised a cycling bridge that might benefit 3,000 people over developing the Mill Road Highway that would support an extra 120,000 people living in southern Auckland?
Mr Speaker, I would refer the member to the fact that we have varied the investment around Mill Road because without that, it would have been the most expensive road in the country at $3.5 billion. It was prudent and necessary to take another look at that investment. The changes that we've made will still allow the acceleration of housing development in a really critical area of Auckland.
Why has she prioritised a $785 million cycle bridge to the North Shore when commuting from Pukekohe to the CBD currently takes more than an hour by car and over 80 minutes one way using rail?
Mr Speaker, you'll see a consistency in the fact that we've made decisions that are investing in high growth areas whilst also working to reduce emissions. For instance, the investments in the south are about better connectivity. We've got another train station going into an area of high growth because our view is we need to provide options to those looking to move around the city. At the moment, we've had, unfortunately, over a number of decades, a very significant investment in roading and not enough investment consistently in public transport options.
Supplementary.
The Honourable Michael Wood.
Does she stand by the government's investments through the New Zealand Upgrade Program in the Papakura electorate in terms of the State Highway 1 investment between Papakura and Drury and the Papakura to Pukekohe electrification project, two projects that will significantly increase the ability of people
order,
to move around Auckland's transport network?
I am going to rule the question out because I have been making it clear to members that they don't add extra things on when they finish their question in the way that the Minister did then.
Supplementary. What is her response to Chair of the Infrastructure Commission, Dr Alan Bollard, who says of the cycle bridge, quote, it will move less than 1% of the existing bridge traffic while subsidising one of the wealthiest suburbs in the country. The arithmetic does not stack up, end quote.
Look, Mr Speaker, I don't necessarily expect every individual to support the idea of providing multimodal transport, but I do believe that if we are going to create an international city where we're able to move people around that city through various modes of transport, and we have as a party and as a government made a commitment to enabling that between the North Shore and the CBD, but we're struck with a structural issue that prevents that, we're working to find our way around that, and that is what we've proposed. I do note that it seems a significant departure for the member and her party who previously had supported a route that connected the North Shore and the CBD. I notice that they no longer support that. I'd be very interested to know whether or not that's the view of all the members in Auckland.
Is $785 million to move less than 1% of traffic from the bridge the type of return she expects when investing taxpayer money?
Mr Speaker, I've previously seen that member's party make decisions on roading projects that did not stack up. We have made a judgment, for instance, on Mill Road that we could not justify the investment in what would become the most expensive project in the country. However, we currently have a connection where people cannot walk, cannot cycle. They are cut off from joining other public transport networks between the North Shore and the CBD. We have estimates of how many would use that daily. That's on a previous business case, but our view is it's a connection that's required.
By how many minutes will the $785 million cycle bridge reduce the average commute time from the North Shore to Auckland CBD, if any?
2 points, Mr. Speaker. Some of the alternatives that have been proposed around using two lanes of the Harbour Bridge to provide the same thing would likely considerably contribute to congestion on the existing route. So that's why we have not favoured that option. When it comes to commute times for this current proposal, if the member chooses to put a question on notice, I'm sure I could provide further information.
What is her response to the people of Ashburton who have been emailing me asking how she was able to find $785 million for a cycle bridge in Auckland, but not $30 million to build them a much-needed second car bridge across the Ashburton River?
The first point I'd make, Mr. Speaker, is actually this is a commitment that has been made some time ago. And as I pointed out yesterday, the issue has been engineering work has demonstrated to us that the original plan is not feasible. The second point on Ashburton, the Minister of Transport visited with the Mayor only last week. Obviously, the issues that we've seen from Slash and the significant flooding event has had an impact on the bridge. NZTA are working very hard to get heavy vehicles back over the bridge in night hours, because at the moment in the evenings they're taking a detour. And I understand that NZTA are talking to local government about a business case for potentially alternative routes. My understanding is that to date that hasn't existed, but we are working closely with them because obviously we see the fragility of the connection down south that's been caused by this flood.
Question number four, the Honourable Eugenie Sage.
To the Minister of Climate Change, will the Government follow the final advice of He Paul Arangi, the Climate Change Commission?
The Honourable James Shaw.
Mr Speaker, the Commission has set out a clear direction for our path to ensure a safe climate for future generations, and we are already moving in that direction. Cabinet will still need to make decisions over the coming months, and I can't preempt those decisions today. But I can say, under the Zero Carbon Act, the Government has to either follow the Commission's advice or come up with a better alternative.
Does he accept the Commission's conclusion that current policies are not enough to meet our targets for a low emissions future?
Yes, I do, Mr Speaker, and that's why the Government's planning to build on the work that we have already begun to reduce emissions. I welcome the Commission's conclusions that existing technologies make taking action affordable, delaying action would be more costly, and that reducing emissions can also have good outcomes for people's health and energy bills. I take heart that the Commission has told us that we are acting in the right areas, like transport, energy, agriculture and waste, but we need our actions to be both bolder and faster.
How will you ensure the Government follows the Commission's advice to work in partnership with Iwi Māori?
Mr Speaker, when Parliament unanimously passed the Zero Carbon Act, we included a specific legal requirement for the Government to pay attention to the effects of climate change for Iwi Māori. The Commission has told us that upholding Te Tiriti o Waitangi, quote, must be at the core of our transition, end quote, and that is very important to the Government.
When will the Government follow the Commission's recommendations to incentivise the uptake of electric cars?
Budget 2021 included $300 million to incentivise the uptake of electric vehicles, and we will be making an announcement about that very soon.
Does he support the Commission's advice to establish 300,000 hectares of new native forests in the next few years, including integrated pest management?
Native forests are essential to achieving both our climate change targets, improving our biodiversity and restoring the ecosystems that sustain us. I agree with the Commission that native forestry can provide enduring carbon sinks that clean our air and protect our environment for future generations.
What does he expect other ministers to do in response to the Climate Commission's advice?
Well, Mr Speaker, climate change requires a response right across the government. Many ministers are already working together to develop the emissions reduction plan, and many departments and agencies are also doing their bit. We know that we have the right tools in the toolbox. Now we need to put them to use. And as the chair of the Climate Change Commission said today, we just need to get on with it. Now,
question number five, and I, Dr. Nehru Leavasa.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister for COVID-19 response. What recent announcements has he made on the rollout of the vaccination program?
Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Mr. Speaker, yesterday the Prime Minister and I announced that Pfizer has scheduled delivery of an estimated 1 million additional doses of the vaccine to New Zealand during July. These consignments will double the number of Pfizer doses we've received this year to more than 1.9 million, enough to fully vaccinate almost 1 million Kiwis. While we know that the ongoing pandemic can impact on vaccine delivery schedules, Pfizer has given us further assurances that the remaining deliveries for 2021 are on track, just as their deliveries right the way through the year so far have been.
Supplementary. How will these additional deliveries support our vaccination rollout?
Mr. Speaker, the deliveries will enable us to continue vaccinating groups 1, 2 and 3, while giving us the certainty we need to start the general population rollout as we had planned. The supplies mean DHBs can continue delivering to their plans and start accelerating their way through Group 3 from July onwards. We're currently administering around 20,000 doses a day. I think our highest point was about just under 23,000 doses. And the Pfizer deliveries throughout July will enable us to ramp this up significantly. At its peak of the program across August and September, it's projected we'll be administering on average up to 50,000 doses per day. This will add significant momentum to the program, the momentum that's already being generated.
Supplementary. How are these deliveries expected to be distributed?
Mr. Speaker, Pfizer have been delivering us weekly amounts of the vaccine, and we expect that to continue. It starts with a larger quantity in the first 2 weeks of July than we have had to date, and then gets up to an even larger quantity in the second 2 weeks of July, which aligns with our work to ramp up the program. I've also been pleased to announce that the extra ultra-low storage freezer, low-temperature storage freezers, have been delivered and are now in place in Auckland and Christchurch, meaning that the vaccines can be delivered directly into Christchurch now without having to go through Auckland.
Is he confident that we are prepared for the national rollout?
Mr. Speaker, yes. District health boards are currently performing over 10% ahead of their delivery plans. We are vaccinating more people each week, week on week, and more than 7,000 vaccinators have completed the necessary training to administer the vaccine. It's exciting and reassuring to see the program is continuing to ramp up. We do have at our disposal one of the best vaccines on the market, and we are making it available for free to everybody in New Zealand who is eligible through the course of 2021.
Supplementary.
Chris Bishop.
Why are 3,800 border workers still not vaccinated when the COVID-19 website says that as members of Group 1, they will be vaccinated by the end of March 2021?
Mr. Speaker, I don't actually accept that that is a fair conclusion to reach. There are some issues around the way people are coded within their vaccination. So we have seen, for example, some people in Group 1B are categorised as Group 3. In terms of Group 1A,
I think this is a matter which most members of the House are trying to take seriously. Having the Minister shouted down by two of the, one of the more senior members and the Shadow Leader of the House doesn't help the House here. Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, in terms of Group 1A, which includes the MIQ workforce and others working at the border, where individual cases have arrived to work in an MIQ, for example, and the Border Worker Testing Register has suggested that they've not been vaccinated, when that has been investigated, it's found that they have been vaccinated, but there is a data issue in terms of the comparability between data sets. The area where we still do have lower than acceptable vaccination rates are at our maritime ports, and further work is being done on that.
Question number six, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Transport. Does the government expect to deliver all the transport projects it announced in January 2020 as part of the New Zealand Upgrade Program? If not, which projects will not go ahead as originally announced?
The Honourable Michael Woods.
Mr. Speaker, as I announced last Friday, the government is delivering New Zealand Upgrade Program projects in all of the regions first announced in January 2020. All projects announced have had some level of change from when they were first announced, for example, with scope changes and or cost changes.
Point of order.
Point of order, the Honourable Michael Waterhouse.
Mr Speaker, the second part of that question was which projects will not go ahead as originally announced, and I don't think the Minister had addressed that question.
Well, I think he did. I think he said all of them, didn't he? Well, he said there were changes made to all of them, so that's...
To the Minister, what were the characteristics of the Otaki to North of Levin project that justify it continuing? And were those characteristics present in the Mill Road project?
Mr Speaker, every project was assessed on its own merits, taking into account a range of considerations, including the issue of how cost escalations will be managed, including the impact on resilience and safety, and including climate change considerations. I do note, Mr Speaker, that in the case of the Mill Road project, the escalation was in the order of $2.2 billion, a magnitude of three times the increase in the Otaki to North of Levin project. Unlike the previous government, which with projects like Transmission Gully kicked cost escalations down the road to be cleaned up, we believe it's more responsible to deal with them at the time.
Were electoral considerations one of those characteristics?
No.
To the Minister, does he agree with the Minister of Finance, who said at the launch of the upgrade program, quote, "The big difference is that they are funded. Every dollar required for these projects is in the government accounts today," end quote.
Mr Speaker, I'm very pleased to confirm that as a result of the decisions that we took on Friday, every single project in the New Zealand Upgrade Program is funded according to the advice that we have received from Waka Kotahi and Kiwirau.
Well, given that answer, will the projects go ahead as announced?
Well, yes, Mr Speaker, that absolutely is the intention of the government.
Question number 7, Jenny Anderson.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Police. What recent reports has she seen regarding police's efforts to disrupt organised crime?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Porter Williams.
I've seen reports that police have concluded a number of operations to disrupt transnational organised crime as part of Operation Trojan Shield and Operation Spyglass. The operations led by the FBI and coordinated with the Australian Federal Police, Europol and numerous other law enforcement partners from across the globe has seen a worldwide crackdown on organised crime. Mr Speaker, I want to take this opportunity to congratulate the police for their role in Operation Trojan Shield and in keeping our communities safe.
How has Operation Trojan Shield disrupted organised crime locally?
Mr Speaker, more than 300 officers executed 37 search warrants across the North Island, with illegal firearms, methamphetamine, cannabis and more than an estimated $1 million in cash has also been recovered. Police have also arrested 35 individuals and laid over 900 charges.
How is the government supporting police in their efforts to disrupt organised crime?
Mr Speaker, this government has made it very clear we will not tolerate organised crime and gangs. Last month we announced our intention to amend the proceeds of crime legislation to ensure that those involved in organised crime would have to demonstrate their assets were obtained through legitimate means. If they can't, their assets will be seized. This government has put on record the number of police on the front line has a specific focus on organised crime. This government's record investment in police will include 700 additional investigators. This operation highlights the excellent impact these officers can have.
Question number 8, Rauru Waititi.
Kia ora, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. Does she stand by all her government statements and actions?
Mr Speaker, yes. In particular, our targeted support in this year's budget to support Māori in areas like housing, health, education, tamariki, whānau, justice reform and te reo Māori. The total Māori budget package is in excess of $1 billion and invests in the areas right across our economic recovery while supporting Māori across the country. Key initiatives include Māori housing, Māori health initiatives, the setting up of the Māori Health Authority, Māori education and particular support for Māori boarding schools and to lift kohanga reo teachers' pay, $42 million to build a sustainable Māori media sector and invest in program content, funding for Māori tourism, and $14.8 million for the implementation of the Māori language strategy. Mr Speaker, this support will help our economic recovery and support Māori.
Very good.
Does she stand by her international commitments as part of the Christchurch call to protect citizens from online hate speech and violent threats, and does this commitment include protection of tangata whenua?
Mr Speaker, yes. In fact, you'll see from the work program off the back of particularly the Royal Commission, so in tandem with, of course, the work on the Christchurch call, but on the Royal Commission, a really strong theme coming through there that we need to involve conversation and dialogue through the reform process with all communities, but particularly tangata whenua as well. And so that is a big part of our response to the Royal Commission's report.
Supplementary. Has she received any reports from the police or the intelligence agencies that demonstrate the rising volume of white supremacist hate and violence against tangata whenua, as expressed vividly in an online by a masked white supremacist who threatened to slaughter tens of thousands of Māori and burn down our marae?
Mr Speaker, whilst we don't tend to comment on the specifics of intelligence reporting, it will be obvious to everyone in this House that we have seen extremist groups, those who hold extremist ideology, those who hold racist ideology, are certainly in existence in Aotearoa New Zealand. Our job is to make sure that we work in a preventative fashion to try and protect people from that ideology and that we respond where we see it using the full force of the criminal justice system. It is, however, up to our police to make sure that they are doing that. They have operational independence. But I understand the member has sought to meet both with the Commissioner of Police around those issues and has met with the Minister for Responsibility for our intelligence agencies. I hope he received a receptive audience to addressing the challenges the member has raised.
Point of order, Mr Speaker. Okay, just for clarity of the House, the Commissioner didn't turn up today.
Supplementary, Mr Speaker. Are her Christchurch core policy changes sufficient when that video, which essentially threatened genocide on tangata whenua, was online on multiple platforms for longer than 24 hours?
Two responses to that, Mr Speaker. Of course, for an incident that occurs, we would expect that when that is raised, that that's then dealt with by the New Zealand police, according to the law. I understand arrests may have been made in the particular case that's being raised. But when it comes to the issue of then the removal of content that's considered to be offensive or objectionable, we are doing some work to ensure that we have consistency in the way that we treat material, whether it's on an online platform, social media content, or indeed through some of our usual mainstream ways that we've accessed content in the past through broadcasting. We know there's more work we need to do there, and we're doing it. And equally, we're trying to lead the charge internationally on making sure there's a consistent approach to take down through social media platforms too. Just in response, I understand the Commissioner has made a commitment to reschedule with the Māori Party on the basis of the unavailability of meeting today.
Supplementary. Will she support the establishment of a joint government task force that includes the NZSIS and New Zealand Police that is focused on protecting tangata whenua from violent white supremacists? And if not, why not?
Mr Speaker, I would have an expectation that we would be undertaking, or that our agencies would be doing that work as a matter of course in their daily duties. So those operational decisions ultimately do exist for them, but I think everyone in this House would expect that anyone that receives threats, anyone that is the subject of threats, either online or in any environment, experiences the full force of the law. And that if we are seeing the rise of some of these groups, and I believe we are, both globally and in our own jurisdiction, that the agencies would respond to that.
Question number 9, Steph Lewis.
Tēnā koe, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Agriculture. What recent announcements has he made about integrated farm planning?
The Honourable Damien O'Connor.
Mr Speaker, yesterday I released the Good Farm Planning Principles Guide to provide guidance for farmers on how they can organise their business operations and help New Zealand meet significant environmental challenges and market opportunities. This guide is the gateway to an integrated farm planning approach. That is, that each farmer are looking at their farm as a whole to streamline compliance, avoid duplication, boost productivity and improve environmental outcomes. Mr Speaker, we have developed the guide in partnership with senior representatives from farming industry organisations, councils and Māori agribusiness, and I welcome their commitment to promoting the value of integrated farm planning across the sector.
How will integrated farm planning help farmers and growers to meet their climate change targets?
Mr Speaker, under the He Waka Eke Noa, a partnership, 25% of farmers and growers will need to have a written plan in place to measure and manage their emissions by the start of next year, and 100% will need to have this in place by the beginning of 2025. In addition, in its final advice out today, the Climate Commission emphasised the importance of improving on-farm practices and disseminating existing good practice more widely. The Integrated Farm Planning Guide released yesterday incorporates the He Waka Eke Noa Farm Planning Guidelines for Greenhouse Gas Emissions that was released in December last year, and making it easier for farmers and growers to integrate climate change requirements into their current farm planning. Mr Speaker, this government is committed to helping increase the uptake of integrated farm planning across the country in support of our climate ambition, so that more farmers and growers better understand their climate impacts and what actions may be required to mitigate them.
How is the government supporting the rollout of integrated farm planning?
Mr Speaker, Budget 2021 invests $37 million towards a national integrated farm planning system. It will deliver 100 more professionals and work with existing organisations who have the skills to provide advice to farmers and growers with aspects of planning. It will also improve information and data interoperability across the primary industries and between regulators and industry assurance programs. An accelerator fund will be set up to invest in targeted initiatives to significantly broaden the uptake of integrated farm planning through great organisations like catchment management groups. Mr Speaker, once integrated farm planning is fully rolled out, up to 40,000 farmers and growers will have the tools they need to improve their on-farm performance and meet their freshwater and greenhouse gas requirements.
Question number 10, Tim Vandermolen.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Building and Construction. Does she stand by her statement when asked if Budget 2021 is wrong in respect of the residential earthquake-prone buildings financial assistance scheme that, quote, on the face of it, it would appear to be, end quote?
The Honourable Fotu Williams.
Insofar that there is a typo in the overview of vote page on vote building and construction that uses the phrase just under $11 million to make assistance available to owner-occupiers or investors in or facing hardship, rather than simply owner-occupiers, yes.
So, did the Minister bother to proofread the appropriation for the budget?
Mr Speaker, it's unfortunate that there is a typo in the overview, but it does not affect the budget appropriation in any way.
So in relation to the criteria then for investors being excluded, how many applications, as opposed to expressions of interest, have been received for the scheme?
Mr Speaker, as I've told this House on a number of occasions now, we are supporting people who have made expressions of interest into to become ready to submit, but at this stage we have not received any applications.
Order. I'm going to apologise for the House. I should have ruled that question out. It didn't flow from either the question or the answer. Further supplementary, Tim Vandermolen.
Has the more than $700,000 spent on administering the scheme, including promotion to applicants, been effective given there have been zero applications?
Mr Speaker, as I explained to the member during the estimates debate, that
The appropriation and the spending thus far has been to support those who have expressed an interest in taking part in the scheme. It's a complex matter needing engineering. We're talking about people generally who do not have technical expertise, but part of the issue is to ensure that they've got the right expertise, the right advice, and that all the other criteria are met, including that they have made applications for funding and have been turned down.
So with the view to trying to attract a single applicant, will she seek advice from the Honourable Megan Woods about how to effectively promote a scheme by perhaps using drones?
Question number 11, Timothy Coffey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Māori Development and asks, what steps has the government taken to support Māori housing aspirations?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Willie Jackson.
Mr. Speaker, since 2019 budget, since that budget, the TPK Housing Investment Program has provided funding for 53 houses on Papakāinga and infrastructure for 115 individual house sites, 824 housing repairs projects and 89 sorted kāinga order programs to build whānau financial capability. Over the past 6 months, I've been able to visit with a number of Māori housing developments, from Papakāinga to affordable rentals like the ones being provided by Rehua Marae in Christchurch. And I'm proud that this government is partnering with Māori to deliver long-term, healthy, sustainable housing options for our people.
Supplementary. How does the Wellbeing Budget 2021 support Māori housing aspirations?
Mr. Speaker, in Budget 2021, $380 million over 4 years has been invested into the Whai Kāinga Whai Oranga program, jointly delivered by Te Puni Kōkiri and the Ministry for Housing and Urban Development. Whai Kāinga Whai Oranga will see TPK working alongside MHUD to deliver funding for about 1,000 houses, including projects on Papakāinga repairs to about 700 whare led by TPK. $30 million towards building future capability for iwi and Māori groups to accelerate housing projects and a range of support services. This is in addition to the Housing Acceleration Fund that was announced in March to increase the supply of affordable homes. $350 million of that fund will be invested in infrastructure to support Māori and iwi providers to build homes for whānau Māori.
Further supplementary. Why is the government making an investment into the Māori housing network?
Mr. Speaker, everyone in this House knows that Māori suffer more adverse housing outcomes more than other New Zealanders, and a contributing factor to this is not being able to secure capital from lending institutions, sir, on whenua Māori. I'm pleased that this government is partnering with iwi and Māori groups to build a repair and develop warm and healthy homes utilising Māori land.
Question number 12, Simon Watts.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Health. What is the total number of staff vacancies across all district health boards, and what specific plans, if any, does he have to address staffing vacancies in the New Zealand health system?
The Honourable Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, the health sector workforce is one of New Zealand's biggest. For example, in 2019, there were approximately 76,000 full-time equivalent employees employed by the 20 DHBs. I'm advised that as at the year ending 31 March 2021, there are approximately 3,668 full-time equivalent vacancies across all DHBs. I note that this includes corporate vacancies and represents less than 5% of the total number of full-time equivalents in 2019. In response to the second part of the member's question, in the short term, all DHBs have active recruitment plans for clinical vacancies. Implementing care capacity demand management is also a priority for the government, and we have funded an additional more than 3,000 nurse roles since 2017. In the long term, we are reforming the health system as a single Health NZ organisation, which will allow for national planning for our workforce and allow us to start investing in and building the workforce we need for the future.
Supplementary. What urgent action will he take to address critical shortage of nurses across district health boards, which number over 1,600 and over 450 at Waikato DHB alone.
Mr. Speaker, by contrast to the previous National Government, this Government committed to increasing the nursing workforce through the Care Capacity Demand Management Scheme, and we have funded an additional more than 3,000 full-time equivalent roles as part of that program. The reality is the DHBs have been struggling to fill many of those roles on a full-time permanent basis. They've been reliant on agency nurses to fill those gaps. But that is why we also made a further investment in terms of training and workforce development. But that has been somewhat haphazard across 20 DHBs. That is why one of the benefits of Health NZ is that we can get a coherent, consistent program of workforce development to start filling those roles on a permanent basis.
Supplementary. Will the almost half a billion dollars in taxpayer money he is spending to restructure the health sector deliver any additional frontline doctors or nurses? If so, how many?
Mr. Speaker, part of the $486 million appropriated for the transition to the new health system includes new commissioning funding for both the Interim Māori Health Authority and Interim Health NZ. That will mean new services, that is to say services that do not exist now but will exist in the future. How those organisations who are contracted or commissioned to provide those services staff those services will be for them, but they will be additional services and they will add to the capacity of our health system.
Supplementary. How can he be confident the government can deliver COVID-19 vaccinations to every New Zealander by the end of the year as planned when the health workforce are struggling to operate with business as usual?
It is struggling, but carry on.
Mr. Speaker, without wanting to tread on the toes of my very good colleague, the Minister for COVID-19 Response, the Honourable Chris Hipkins, what I can say is that because of the very fine planning done by those responsible for it, that we are ahead of our planned target achievement for the COVID-19 vaccination rollout, and we remain confident that we will fulfil our vaccination target as required by the end of the year.
That concludes oral questions.